Crumb.
Lexington. Then welcome to my podcast. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring. Welcome back, everybody, to the Savage Cromcast. I'm Josh.
I'm Luke.
I am Jonathan. And we're definitely going to be big in Romania after this season.
Huge in Romania.
Huge. Can tell. Definitely not going to insult them.
No. I don't think so. I don't think so. Is Dracula. And boy, we are back with a brand new season, traveling along that Wallachian road toward Romania, toward Transylvania, a small province, right, John?
It is. It seems to be a small corner tucked away in a bloodstained region.
All of chapter one of this book is about Transylvania.
Yeah. It is. I've read that Bram Stoker had as many as 100 pages of notes that helped him to build some of the backstory to all of the history and stuff that he was putting together for Dracula. And boy, can you tell it in that first chapter.
Yep. He's got notes, and not just history, but folklore and superstition as well. And we're going to talk about all that coming up. Brand new episode, brand new season. We're talking about Dracula. The first 8 chapters this week on the Cromcast. How's it going, guys? Good?
Good. I'm feeling my oats. I'm excited to talk about this spooky story. I think it has a slow burn on the front end, but it gets going pretty quick. And it's a cool science story, too. I'm excited to see what you guys think about this. I guess I'm really excited to see what John thinks about it as we get into it, because he's the noob for reading Dracula, but... Josh and I have a good love for this story, so I'm curious to see kind of how the conversation goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some good East meets West and tradition meets technology and all of these things wrapped up into this romantic gothic vampire story.
With a little bit of sex on top.
Yeah, yeah.
Put a little bit of whip topping and a cherry on top.
Love on top?
That's the extra crazy, level to
crazy.
It.
Come on, crazy.
Love on top. This is like Beyonce, right? No?
I don't know what that means. And I know you don't know what Luke is talking about.
Beyonce sings a song called Love on Top, and it's a veiled sort of reference to different ways you could make love.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
Is that going to come up in this? Was Beyonce around in 1897?
Beyonce's eternal.
Beyonce is timeless.
And I would hazard to say that Lucy was channeling that Beyonce energy.
Yeah. Yeah. Lucy is bae, I think, is what the kids would say.
I love it.
I have to go back and analyze this text.
You got to read it again. All right. Let's
the vibe that I was getting.
Clearly, some of us have been drinking a little bit more than others thus far. But I never drink wine. That's not in the book. That's in the movie. John, what's in your cup?
I'm not having wine either. I am having some Wild Turkey 101, which I think would probably kill Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
It's blessed by the holy man himself, Jimmy Russell.
Jimmy Russell blesses it. Every blessed barrel.
He puts a bit of Kentucky holy water in there.
And how many staves?
Have you ever seen a vampire in Kentucky?
Good point. Nope. No. Well, there's those Murray State, but they drove to Florida.
Oh,
we'll talk about it. Yeah. Don't look up vampires in Kentucky, anybody.
No, I forgot about that. I didn't mean to make that joke now.
No, it's okay. It's been, that was in the early 90s, dude.
True. That's a sad story.
It is bad.
We gotta face it.
Yeah.
It's true. But that's what I'm drinking to sort of expedite us away from my faux pas. And I'll turn the torch over to Luke. What are you drinking?
I am drinking Benchmark Old Number 8, but it is not 8 years old anymore. So I'm drinking Benchmark Number 8. and some Kroger soda water. And then the other thing that I have is my big ass Stanley thermos full of coffee, because it's been a long day and I might need a little bit of go-go juice to push me through. So that's what I'm doing. I'm speedballing here with Benchmark whatever the Costco, like the green bag of coffee is. That's what I get going.
Yeah.
But you brewed it this morning and it's still hot.
Hey man. Yeah. You get yourself a Stanley thermos and you like screw that thermos down tight and you're good to go.
It's just like hot. Luke's takes on the Chromecast. His coffee is hot. And this has been brought to you by Stanley Thermos. Some native advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So Benchmark and coffee is what I got going. What about you, Josh?
I've got a High Life, which is the champagne of beers, as we know. So it is written. And I also have some Wild Turkey.
Blessed be.
so let it be done. And I have some Wild Turkey 101 as well. So I'm mixing. I'm chasing.
I like how fancy we are.
They're BFFs.
This highfalutin podcast talking about Dracula and Gothic literature.
Mm-hmm.
We're drinking Wild Turkey 101, Benchmark bourbon, and High Life, the champagne of beers. That's what we got going.
We're chasing that buzz, that elusive flame of eternal life.
But we never forget our roots, and we keep the banter up.
Beloved banter.
Long may it live.
Speaking of a banter segment, a long-running banter segment, dare I say, an original, let's discuss one thing.
One thing.
John.
That's
Do you want to start us out with a thing?
I will start us out with a thing. I am excited to share that I recently finished Invincible, the comic book series. I have the three compendiums, the Image put out a while back. I got a couple of them on a deep cut sale because they're kind of nick and dent from in-stock trades. And then I found the third one, I think, at half price. And I finally was like, I'm going to read all of this. I've made it through probably the first eight of the traditional trades of Invincible, like four or five times in my life, checking them out from the library. And I always really liked it, but I would run out of steam or I'd run out of books and I couldn't reserve them at the library anymore. So I was finally glad to be able to get through all of it. And it's a cool little piece of superhero fiction. I like the way that Kirkman kind of skewers the genre. He is clearly like taking the piss out of things at Marvel and DC at multiple times. But it was really cool. I don't know if either of you are fans or have read it. I know that some people have been spurred to it by the show. I haven't seen that. It's on Amazon. But Invincible, it's a cool little superhero run, and it's complete. And you get the beginning, middle, and end, which is rare for a comic book story. So check it out if you're interested.
Yeah, I've never read all of Invincible. In fact, I think I've only read the first trade.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's a good one. There's a lot of good stuff in there. He goes through a lot of growth as a character, and there's space opera, there's teenage angst. It's what if Spider-Man was Superman, and it's hard to go wrong with a premise like that if you're willing to commit to it, I think.
I haven't thought of it that way, but I think you're right. There's some good heel turns, too, that
there is.
Now everybody, I guess, knows about. But yes. Yeah, at the time, it sure was a shocker.
But that's mine. So I will again relinquish the talking stick to Luke.
It's me, is it?
It's you.
Oh, God.
It's me, is it?
We're moving into 2022, but
jeez,
I know that's crazy.
The future. We're in the future.
I'm thinking about like music that I really enjoyed over the past year. You know, there's a lot of the metal pages that have the best of the year list, that kind of thing. And so really basically over the entirety of December, I've been kind of looking at music that I've listened to, but also I guess music that I haven't checked out to. That's kind of been in my head every year since I've kind of been in the metal world, like looking at the internet and trying to see what else is out there beyond what I've picked up on the CD and that kind of thing. I always kind of come around to these lists. So I've been looking around at those and I've been thinking about what are my favorite albums And so I guess my one thing for tonight is going to be kind of the top album that I liked last year, so in 2021. And it's a weird one. So there's this band, and I guess I'll just like I'll refer to them as Effed Up. That's the official name of the band. They had an album back in like 2008 that was called like David Comes to Life, which is great. They're kind of a hardcore band, but they dabbled in a lot of different genres over the years. But they have an album that dropped in 2021 called The Year of the Horse. And it is this crazy, massive, like four tracks. It's essentially like two sides of two records. It's kind of how it's put together. So it's about four 20-minute songs that tell this grand, sweeping, weirdo story that's pretty sword and sorcery and pretty badass in its scope. But it's hard to explain, so I won't attempt it. But it mixes up some great metal and rock and little trip-hoppy bits and pieces occasionally, and like spaghetti western music and all kinds of crazy stuff. This is a far out album, but if you're interested in this album, we'll put it on the blog page. But again, the band is Effed Up, and the album is Year of the Horse. That's my one thing.
Nice. I've heard you talk about that album, but I've still not really listened to it.
It is a far out weird trip, but it really is one of those things that, given that you're dealing with like four different tracks that are all 20 minutes in a piece, and they all kind of segue into one another. Like, you can't even really say that it's four songs. It's all one contiguous flow of music. You just got to listen to it. So you need to be able to dedicate the time, whether you're on the road or in the lab, in the office, or you just got the headphones on the head and you can really sit down and go for a trip. You got to be able to do that to absorb it all.
Nice.
What about you, man?
I was going to say one thing, but then when you mentioned your thing, I switched my things. So there is a metal band that I enjoy that I've mentioned as a one thing before, and that is Hermoder, who is, let's see, I think they're from Sweden originally. And I think it's a one man band. Like, it's just one dude.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's kind of the classic, like, one black metal fellow, like, with a laptop and a lot of instruments doing their thing.
Uh-huh. And he really does a great job of weaving sounds together. And so the first album that I listened to that I really enjoyed from them was Forest Sky, from early in 2019. But they released one in December of 2020 that I only realized was out earlier this winter, and that is called The Sea of Dragons. And have you listened to it, Luke? You're giving me the thumbs up.
I have, yeah. It's good. I like it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, continuing that sort of tradition of just melding these heavy guitar sounds, and it's just a soundscape. And the guy, I wish I knew what his name was. I'm on Encyclopedia Metallum right now. I guess it's just Hermoder, is able to use various screams and growls and at, you know, to different effect, almost as though it's part of the instrumentation of the composition. And dude, it's just good stuff. I don't fancy myself really a black metal guy. They're, you know, it's just really not my favorite subgenre, but this dude is able to put together some really awesome, interesting compositions. So check out Hermoder and listen to The Sea of Dragons, and also listen to Forest Sky. It's a couple of years older, but both of those are super, super good. And he's got a deep catalog, it looks like, but those albums are the only two that I've really dug into.
Yeah, they're accessible, right? Like, black metal has this span of just being blast beats and squalling and lo-fi reproduction of the sound, like, whenever they're recording, to something that's a bit more, I don't know, like Venom is black metal, right?
Yeah.
And it's not anthemic, but it's definitely melodic, and it's got like a classic sort of metal feel. And the guy that you're talking about here, it's accessible, right?
Yeah.
Like there's the wash of sound. Like his vocals are a little bit, they're not buried in the recording, but they're not at the forefront. And there's the black metal like squalls and growls that you get, but it's pretty accessible heavy metal material that's being played out, and it's that long form kind of story music too.
Mm-hmm. And this album, Sea of Dragons, is the tracks don't have names; they're just 1 through 9, and they definitely all feel like different movements of a larger piece. They operate together in sequence. It's tough to, you know, tease apart like what tracks you should listen to, because, you know, much like I guess a prog album is, like, it's just different movements of the same sort of composition. So anyway, I sound like a total D-bag railing on about this band and this music, but do check them out. They're really, really good. And, you know, everyone listening probably already knows about them, but I didn't realize this album was out, and I enjoy it. And that's my thing.
That's all of our things.
That's three things.
Yep. Put them in a washing machine. You circle them around, and what do you get?
One thing.
Okay. Now, my children of the night, let's dim the lights down low. Let's venture onto that diligence that's moving up into the mountains, the foothills of the Carpathians, and let's travel, if you will, to Transylvania, across the woodland, to the ancient world.
Sounds like you were setting up an episode of War.
Kind of, yeah. Except it's Dracula.
It's Dracula.
So there's a number of ways we could tackle this, and I wonder if the better approach might be to just discuss the segments of the story and talk about Harker's leg of the journey, and then talk about what happens with Mina and Lucy. What do you guys think of that? Or would you rather decompartmentalize it and talk about the whole thing overall just as it comes up?
I think it comes compartmentalized, so it's probably best to kind of slice through it like that.
Yeah,
I think so too. This is a story definitely that has some reliance of everything that Lucy and Mina are talking about relies on Jonathan. Mm-hmm. So talking about Jonathan first and then later, I think is good.
And it's cool in that, you know, one thing that Dracula, the novel, is famous for is being an epistolary tale, just full of journal entries and letters and pictograph recordings, just everything all rolled into one. Was there anything in this story that you guys noticed that you were impressed by or that struck you before we really dig into the meat?
I guess I can talk as the guy that hasn't read it before. I mean, it's moody as all get out, right? Like, once you get past, I think, some of the things that we were joking about at first, the like travel log sort of Jonathan Harker goes to Budapest, like, oh boy, kind of stuff in the first chapter or two chapters. It's dark and brooding, and there are dogs in the darkness and red glowing eyes, and the physical descriptions are very evocative. So I just thought that Stoker clearly had a flair for the dramatic. I don't know what he was like as a person in real life, but his writing betrays a, I don't want to say romantic, but like, is it Baroque? It's a very pretty way of talking about dark things.
I think you're right on. I mean, he definitely was a romantic. Like, he wrote a variety of novels over the history of his career, and they were all kind of referred to as romantic to varying degrees. You know, Dracula is the most outright horror. Like, what, the Lair of the White Worm is this weird supernatural thing that he did, but they were all in that vein. And they've got that feel to it. I guess the thing that stands out to me, well, I guess two things. He writes like newspaper clippings, and that to me is a cool next level move on his part with the epistolary structure. And then he also is able to write John Seward like dictating into a phonogram or a phonograph. He's writing to a record, which is relayed via the structure of the novel. It doesn't necessarily change how the story comes across, but I think the fact that he says like the bit of the story that you're getting here was recorded to a record is super cool. it's just him sort of advancing the science. And I know we'll talk about this with Frankenstein here in a few episodes when we get into more like the birth of science fiction, but this is a science fictional tale in a lot of ways too. Mm-hmm. And it's cool that Dracula really mixes the romantic with the new world, and I like that. And Seward's just the bee's knees. He's a cool dude. Like I love his overall persona. He's a great character, but the way that Seward is recording to phonograph, and also the way that we get all of the bits and pieces about the Demeter, is super cool. And to me, that's different. Like that epistolary structure that we get here in Dracula is a little bit different than, like, I mean, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but like with any of the Lovecraft stories that we've covered so far, like are there instances of a classic epistolary stories that kind of don't just pull from like letters and journals, that actually pull from news articles? Have we talked about anything on that front?
You know, I the only one that comes to mind is The Call of Cthulhu, and I can't remember if The Call of Cthulhu is more than just the collated notes that the narrator has put together. But that sucker goes how many levels deep? We've talked about this before. It's, a person recounting an interview, and the interviewee is telling him about a meeting that he had with, an artist who then had a dream. Right. Like it's deep, deep, deep. But the Call of Cthulhu is the closest thing that I can think of off the top of my head to this.
And so that's what I've thought about. Like that's been the main basis of comparison, that story has these levels, and there's a variety of kind of types of information that are being presented, but they're still journalistic. And so the ability to write the news article, or to say I'm mixing up mediums and here's the phonogram. Again, it doesn't change what's coming out of Seward's mouth, but just to like make you imagine something different, to me, is a cool thing. So that is, I think, interesting with the way that this is structured up.
Yeah, I do too. And sort of dovetailing off of that, the thing that I noticed is the cool use of the technology of the day. And the thing that really made me want to dig in to research a little bit more, because I don't know much about the history of photography, is that Harker mentions that he used his Kodak to snap pictures of the Carfax Abbey that Dracula has purchased, right? The Carfax property. And he's got these photos with him. And I looked up, thanks to Leslie Klinger's New Annotated Dracula as a resource, I looked up the history of Kodak cameras. And evidently what you would do is you would purchase a camera. You would have to be wealthy at the time in order to do this, although fairly soon after the late 1800s, it became more affordable. You take all of the pictures. There might be 60-some exposures on there. And then you send it off, and they develop the photos and send it back to you. And that's an extra little charge as well. But the Klinger has a diagram, like a schematic of what these early cameras look like. It's just super cool. It's like a box with a tube through it. And, just imagining these technologies clashing with Dracula and the folklore and superstition that he represents is pretty neat to me. Like that's what you were saying earlier, Luke, about this kind of being a science fictional story. That's where that comes in to me, is the use of technology. John just sent us a Kodak Camera 100 advertisement, $25. Is that dollars or pounds? Dollars. Anybody can use it. No knowledge of photography is necessary. The latest and best outlet for amateurs. 100 instantaneous pictures.
It's so cool.
That is cool.
Yeah, it really is. And I hate to even like invoke this term. It's not steampunk. This is just like this is the world. Like the way that Stoker is presenting this romantic, Baroque, Gothic novel. Like it's those three terms: romantic, Baroque, and Gothic. Like those are the descriptors that we can use to describe his writing style and the intention of like his plot. But it's couched within this new age, newfangled world. It's cool. People have been doing this up to this day, right? Like you take something that's this old, archaic story, but you drop it into a newfangled setting, and away you go. Like Stoker is, I don't know. I haven't read his novels. I've read some of his other short stories, but this novel is so. It's such a monster. It's such a monolith. It's such a, like, it's a Godzilla within the field. Like, it's just so omnipresent in the way that it's structured. I just love it so much. And I don't know. I don't want to be so, effusive or just going over the top with my love of it all at the outset here. But I think it's unavoidable with just what we're going to be talking about here.
I kept waiting for somebody to crack out a Coca-Cola bottle. Wouldn't they be around at this time as well?
I would think so, yeah. I'm not sure how they were marketed in England, but yeah, certainly there would be cocaine-laced Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting facet, the fact that we are in the real world. That's a cool thing to hit on.
And we're just sort of peeling back the veil of the existence of these horrific, you know, supernatural creatures. And we don't really get a lot, at least in the first little bit of this novel, in terms of how many vampires there might be overall, like in the world, how you even make a vampire, how you become one, that all that stuff is kind of left out. We get a little bit more of it later in the book, but even the stuff we get is not spelled out completely. That's cool. There's a lot of mystery, I think, in this. And there's a lot of things that Harker and his side, I guess, don't quite understand about Dracula, even to the very end. So shall we talk about Harker and his journey through the countryside of Transylvania and his experience in Castle Dracula? How should we approach this thing?
Yeah. So let's talk about his story and some of the notable things that we want to get into on the Jonathan Harker side, and then we'll jump over to the gals that are over on the British Isles, right? We'll talk about Lucy and Mina.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's do that. And then I'll kind of like, maybe the way to talk about this just generally is we're going to get to the point where Dracula reaches England, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's essentially where our stopping point is, so we can kind of talk about the story up to that point.
So here's a question for you guys before we like do any kind of window dressing or stage setting. Why does Dracula want to go to England?
It's his version of the New World.
Yeah.
Sort of like it's a way of getting out of Carpathia. I don't know what happens. Obviously, I'm the Lucy of the show or the Mina of the show.
You are the Lucy of the show.
I don't really know what's going to happen next, but to me it sort of seems, I don't know if it's gotten boring for him in the Carpathian area in Transylvania, like if he's bored with his life of nobility over these peasants, and then he hears about these teeming masses of millions of people in London, and maybe it presents a challenge to him, but also opportunity. Like there's ways to make money. There's ways to eat more people. There's different kinds of people. Like the people that are around him in Transylvania, they're all so cowed. Like they're all so terrified of him. I guess if I was a Dracula, if I was a vampire, I would be bored with that. Like at a certain point, there's even a part where he talks about sort of the blood and thunder that's in the veins of the Dracula family. Like he yearns for challenge, and perhaps London and England represents that to him.
Yeah, everybody back home probably tastes like cold French fries to him. Like, he's just, he is an adventurer. He is a sword and sorcery motivated blood and thunder character, as you kind of say, John.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, he wants to fight. He wants to win. What is it that Conan says? I burn. I live with life. I fight and slay, and I'm content.
Yeah,
I think Dracula's got a little bit of that inside of him, and is interested in what London could possibly present him as a challenge. Plus, he gets to learn all of the laws and stuff. It seems like he's really into that. it just seems like a big puzzle for him.
One thing you said really, really struck me, John, and that is this notion of Dracula as a sword and sorcery character. And there's a part where he's talking to Harker and he's telling him, hey, I want to know all the customs. I want to know how to speak appropriately. I want to know the right intonation and inflection. And I want to know, like you said, the laws, such that, you know, I've been master for so long that I would have no one be master over me, or I would be master still. And so he definitely is moving into this new adventure with this notion of, you know, I'm going to conquer. And if I can't conquer, then I'm at least going to make sure that no one can conquer me.
He's got big plans.
Yeah, big
very
plans.
Clearly. Yeah. Are we talking about favorite things, or are we unpacking what happens to Harker?
Whatever you will. You're next. I had a question for you guys, so you can go. You can go next.
Oh, I was just going to, I guess, part of what I really liked in this whole, I guess, scene where he's talking about the family Dracula and what they've done throughout history. This was one of my favorite things. And I bet, have we ever heard that Howard liked this book? I would presume as such.
We talked about this with Dracula's guest. Timeline is such that is it the Horror in the Mound? Horror on the Mound?
Mm-hmm.
That probably Howard had a dose of the Demeter and had some of that information informing his writing. I don't know if we have any clear evidence that Howard read Dracula, but he seems like he saw the movie. And so we covered that in our last Cromtober.
Right.
Yeah. So with lines of evidence from letters that Darius pointed out, as well as an essay or two from Mark Finn and Jeff Shanks, it seems like there's connections there to be made, but it's the connections between Howard and the Dracula movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha. So those are the connections.
Okay. Well, I think that he would definitely dig this part where he's talking about the rise and fall of empires in the Balkan states. Like, this was a part that stuck out to me. It's a part of history that I always want to know more about. Like, the all these different people. Like, I think it's at one point described as the boundary waters or the mixing waters for all of Europe and Asia. Like, all of these races and people are there. They're always being conquered and unconquered, and the Turks are showing up and then leaving and being defeated. I was quite taken with his description just of the history of his region, and I think it would be something that wouldn't be out of place in a Howard work. So I thought that was kind of one of the things that piqued my Howard meter, but it sounds like maybe he cheated and saw the movie rather than read the book.
Yeah, I think the movie was big doings, and I do remember seeing a letter, I don't know who it's to, maybe Tavis Clyde Smith, but he mentions that maybe they should go check it out.
It would have been cool to see a movie with Robert E. Howard.
That would have been something, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I don't imagine he talked at the screen, but...
Who knows?
Maybe.
Don't go in there.
So I apologize for derailing us slightly. Let's talk more about what happens to Harker. Like, he shows up in Transylvania. He is transported by several trains, which he sort of regrets that they are tardy a lot of the times. But he gets to see a lot of beautiful countryside. He's picked up eventually by what seems to be, to me, a haunted wagon that's very clearly piloted by somebody you shouldn't accept a ride from. Before he gets on that, he meets tons of backdrop characters who are all clearly very superstitious folks, and he is this like haughty Englishman. It's obvious that he looks down on them in their backward ways of like slipping him rosaries, these vile sort of abominations that you're not supposed to have, their effigies or whatever. And they're slipping him flowers and roses and saying different kinds of curse words that he's translating on the go with his pocket dictionary. And he just thinks little of them and doesn't trust what clearly are indicators that he's wandering into some trouble.
Yeah, it's pretty clear he's going into a trap. He's not gonna make it back out. And I love the part where he's looking up the words that the people are using, and among them are devil and witch and this and that. And he eventually does get onto, like you said, another carriage that you shouldn't get onto, being driven by someone who's very superstitious. And I guess. Is it plain to you guys that the driver of this coach is Dracula?
I don't think at this point in the story it is.
Okay.
To me, it's never outright struck me that way. It's a weird thing. This very opening salvo of the novel is still a difficult thing to summarize to somebody, much less present on the screen, like the Francis Ford Coppola movie tried to do with the flames and the overall coach experience. It's a bizarre thing. It never, when I first read it, struck me that it was Dracula, but of course in retrospect I see that
it is pretty weird. And this is the first read through where I've been convinced that it must be Dracula and not just somebody in his thrall. But I remember the first time that I saw the Universal Dracula, and Bela Lugosi plays the coach driver. That, like, it's obviously him, and he's obviously doing his Dracula thing. And I remember just thinking how weird that is. But it makes sense, I think, in the context of the story that coach driver knows things that he should not know otherwise. Like, he's able to either hear really well, or he can read minds or something. So there's something really weird going on with him. But we get to the castle and a whole bunch of weird things ensue. Do you guys have a favorite weird thing that happens to Jonathan Harker at Castle Dracula?
He falls asleep in the wrong room at one point and wakes up to like the chittering laughter of three beautiful ladies. And I really liked the setup to where he falls asleep, because he's been warned not to do this. And he's getting madder and madder at this point that he's being held prisoner, and like sort of knows his days are numbered. And so he's like, oh yeah, screw you, I'll sleep wherever I want. And he finds this locked, hidden room. And for some reason he's taken with it and believes that like breathless women with heaving bosoms or something used to write letters in it in the past. Am I reading that correctly, Josh?
I think he imagines that this writing stand, this desk might be where some lady wrote romantic letters and notions to her love.
Yeah, and there's
like romantic, a beautiful view.
Mm-hmm. Sexy.
There's a beautiful view, and then he is like, "I'm gonna sleep here. Screw Dracula. I'll do whatever I want." And he wakes up to this. I really like the way that it's presented, almost as this like sleep paralysis situation, which I don't know that they knew fully about then. I know there's paintings and stuff from the past that sort of demonstrate it, but he has this very vivid dream where he can't move and three women are about to dine on his neck and he is saved, quote unquote, by Dracula. And just the very dreamy nature of it, it was very beautiful and very creepy. And I thought that was the weirdest thing that happened to, I mean, amongst a dozen other weird things, but for me, that one kind of took the cake.
Yep. And they eat a baby. That's the.
How could I forget the baby eating?
That's the capper on that. No, I agree, John. That is the spookiest moment. And if you've never read this, once you hit that point, you're like, oh shit, Blaster just got lit up, and we're going full tilt into horror. Like, that is a truly spooky, horrific moment for sure.
And it's built really nicely. I wanted to say, like, Harker is starting to realize that Dracula clearly there's something odd about him. There are no servants anywhere. He's kind of psychotic, right? Like, kind of controlling. He's basically told Harker, hey, why don't you write these three letters and tell everybody you're going to stay here with me for a month? I think at this point, Dracula has like freaked out at the sight of Harker's blood. and told him what a precious thing that is in these times in this country. So yeah, there's a lot of crazy weird things that have happened, and then that happens, and it's very frightening. I love it.
And there's extra, like, the thing that makes that whole scene to me work on the next level are all of the extra plot elements that are thrown out there. Like the I'm thinking here of the Coppola movie, but the I Too Have Loved. Like, there's like, that's actually, I think that's in the written form that Stoker has, that you've got the coquettish blonde nubile younger of the daughters slash wives, which is a cool interesting, complicated kind of thing to unpack. Like, who are these three vampire mistresses? Like, what is their relation to them? But you've got this, it is so very sexual, and you have this distinction between Dracula, the ruler and the master, versus these three subordinate vampires, and kind of who are they? There's just a lot to unpack here about who the brides of Dracula are. And to me, like, the first third of the novel, it's I don't want to say it's totally their show, it's Dracula's show, but without having those badass lieutenant bad guys in the story, this story would be lame-o. If it was just like Spooky House, Saturnine Continents, Sharp Teeth, oh, Arabian Nights, I must go to bed, it would be lame. But you inject the my heart is given to Mina, and I'm in loved and betrothed, and oh my god, three sexy vampire ladies.
I would give anything. Yeah, when in Transylvania.
Like, at one point, Jonathan uses the term, like, super sensitive or something. Like, it's, he talks about basically the vampire ladies kissing on his neck and sort of moving ever so slightly. It is oh so erotic. It's so damn spooky. And you feel for Jonathan. Like, he is a good guy through and through. You know, he's writing these things in his diary, but Mina must not see them. And it's great. So I agree, John. Like, that is the standout scene to me too. But all of the wrappings and the dressing on top of that just really adds to it.
Yeah. So they say, you yourself never loved, you never love, which I think is like they adapted that line word for word to the Coppola movie. And he replies, yes, I too can love. You yourselves can tell it from the past. Is it not so? Well, now I promise you that when I am done with him, you shall kiss him at your will. I think kiss is in quotes here. It should be air quotes. Right. Now go. I must awaken him, for there is work to be done. And then, are we to have nothing tonight? And he pulls out this bag, and Jonathan passes out. It's a very Lovecraftian kind of response from our protagonist, right?
It's horrible. And then the mother shows up outside the castle walls, and she's calling and crying, give me back my baby. It is like this story, it pulls no punches, man. Like, that's
no.
That's the thing that's just so cool, is that it is, it's old, but man, it Stoker was like swinging for the fences with a lot of the horror. Like, a lot of the sex is subtext, but there's so much that's just outright there in the story.
And it's Victorian England, right? Like, you know, this is a super, super repressed people who are doing super, super kinky things behind closed doors and not talking about it. Or when they write about it, they're saying, oh, we kissed. Like, you know, sure you did. Yeah, that's all you did.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, that John, you're onto it. That is one of the fever pitches, I think, in this first four chapters.
Well, I feel maybe like I'm the doofus Jonathan in real life then, because I'm not picking up on any of this like sexy time stuff, but I'm learning as you guys discuss.
I thought there were major boners. on Harker's in the story. Yeah. For sure.
Harker is super repressed. He's a super great guy. He wants to go home. He wants to marry Mina. He wants to just be a partner in this firm and have a great life. But like, here he is in this horrible situation, and he's seeing this situation he never could have imagined himself in. Right? I mean, how many times can you read the word voluptuous in the span of a couple pages and not think about these types of scenarios being there being more to it than just, oh, I hope they don't bite me with those sharp looking teeth.
However many times it's there, that's how many times I can read it and not think about this stuff.
Fair enough.
I'm not arguing with you. I absolutely see it on the face now that you're saying it. But yeah, I definitely was just like, oh, now we're talking about vampires.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is pretty much the first, like sign of Stoker showing us his hand. Like these definitely are vampires.
It's confirmation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And as you know, as Harker's diary entries continue, of course, he climbs out the window at one point after having seen Dracula climb out the window like a freaking lizard and scaling around and sending off letters in his visage and all that kind of stuff. He gets to the point where he sees a crypt with the count in it, and that's pretty spooky altogether. But this is really the first hints that, oh my god, we are not just trapped in here because of some weirdo cuckoo, but he's a monster.
Yeah.
They're a monster.
Yeah, he finds Dracula in a box, like, in his native Earth, which is a phrase I can't say with a straight face now after having watched several seasons of What We Do in the Shadows. But he's gonna end him, right? Like, he picks up a shovel and he's gonna chop him. That's
like vampire sleep paralysis. All he can do is stare at him and smirk menacingly. Like, he's got the Amazon smirk on his face when he pitches him backwards with the shovel at one point. Like, he can't even defend himself. It's so weird.
Yeah, I think
it's bizarre.
He's recharging, right? Like, this is also the point where Harker notices that Dracula is aging in reverse. Like, he's getting he's getting younger, and the gray hair is what?
Yeah.
He's doing his Benjamin Button thing.
Well, the descriptions of Dracula at various points are all very fascinating. The fact that he's got hairy palms and his eyebrows are a couple of wiggly caterpillars that nearly meet in the middle before he de-ages. He is, I think, an Englishman's perception of what Eastern Europeans must look like, right? Or at least the monstrous ones. He's even got pointed ears.
I think that those are all folkloric signs of being a werewolf. And we even get imagery of Dracula, like when his mouth is closed, you can still see his fangs. Right.
I was
like,
curious about some of that. I didn't know this as a vampiric thing to command the dogs of the night, the wolves of the night. Like, are you guys familiar with that as a vampire trope?
I think just mainly from this. Yeah. You're able to command bats and wolves and
bats,
you know, the weather and mists and fog.
The things of the night, not necessarily wolves, though.
The creatures of the night, right? As Josh has voiced so often.
What music like, they make?
That's the hint, anyway, is what I've always got.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we get, like, not just a hint, but the scene where the lady comes to the castle weeping, wanting her child back. Like, we see Dracula on a parapet basically commanding the wolves to come and eat her.
Yeah, no, when I say the hint, I mean like in other media. Like this story, it's pretty clear. Like, Dracula has control of the wilds, and specifically wolves and dogs. But in other medium, it's something that's sort of hinted at, you know, with like a sneer. But here, it's so crazy. Like, whenever, like, the eating of the baby is spooky, but... And that sounds horrible to even say.
But
like, that is horrible. But the mother showing up outside the castle walls and then go into the wolves, that's like next level evil. Dracula is a son of a bitch, right? Like, you truly see how horrible this whole story is. And again, it's hardcore, man. Like Stoker is putting together a narrative that, I mean, I just don't like this hard. It's hard to rival it today, finding these really cool, like, striking evil moments in it.
And there have been so many iconic performances of Dracula, but we don't get these moments where you get glimpses of the real darkness that he represents.
Yeah, you're right. This would be hard to pull off. This would be some serious, like, what Eggers, like the guy that did The Witch and and The Lighthouse. Like, you'd have to get some really stark presentations of things to get this to work on screen today. I mean, without it coming across as just like splattery and exploitation-y, which is not the way that it plays actually on the page, of course.
Oh, John, here's my note. This is the description that Harker feels when those women are about to get him. He's got a wicked burning desire.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying I'm clueless. Wicked.
He had a wicked burning desire.
My hair's on my neck.
You're standing up. And now we're going to...
I just felt like he was in danger.
Oh, okay.
Boing.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Well, let's...
I don't need the boner sound effect.
That was the hairs on his neck standing up, dude.
I didn't need that in my life. Yeah. I know.
That was the boing.
You can't know what it was. Shall we leave this cursed land where the devil and his children still walk with earthly feet?
We need to go to some chaste, earnest, good-hearted women.
Leave the West and return to the East.
We'll move to
the other way around.
The fairer of the sexes, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about Mina and Lucy and what they're up to. One cool thing here that I've never really paid close attention to on rereads of this book is when these different journal entries and newspaper clippings happen in relation to one another. And even this time, I still didn't really jot down everything and make a timeline. But when we go to Mina in chapter 5, we have gone back in time, right? Our first entry from Mina is a letter to Lucy, and it's dated 9th of May. And our last entry from Harker is late June, June 30th.
Yeah, and at one point... Mina is talking about, like, it's been a while, but I've heard from Jonathan. Like, there's a few cues if you're just reading along without paying attention to the dates on the missives that you might be able to sort of see where things catch up. And I don't know, maybe I've used this comparison. I feel like maybe it was in the last episode we recorded. But if you had, like, sliding scales of timelines of stories. Oh, I know, I was talking about Bobby Darin and his ability to sort of, like, put together these cool weird tales for all of us. But if you had, like, these sliding scales, there's a point in time where you get a couple of narratives that sort of like the linchpin sort of pops in and things link up. You can kind of see that, and it kind of comes through. I think Stoker's pretty adept at delivering that point.
And I think that's cool because we get to see that progression of anxiety within Mina, and we get to see, like, pre-corrupted Lucy.
Yeah, she starts off good, and we see the degradation. And maybe that's probably the best indicator of where we're at in the story, right? Like Lucy's doesn't start to go downhill, of course, until Dracula is there and biting on her. So that's kind of a timeline. But that kind of syncs up immediately with where stuff goes south for Harker.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like at the worst moments. So I was kind of being smarmy whenever we were working towards the segue of saying, like, let's move over to these chaste, fairer of the sexes portion of the story, and let's talk about the women. What did you guys think about the overall presentation of, like, Mina and Lucy's letters? Because they are far from contemporary presentations of women, right? Like, objectively pretty vulgar in a lot of ways. But how did you guys read those things?
John, what do you think? How did you, we're on chapter five. How did you approach or receive these letters from Mina and from Lucy to one another?
It makes them seem really young, I guess. Young and naive and inexperienced. Like, I think maybe part of that is the stark contrast of the fact that we just had a gaggle of baby-eaten broads over in Romania. But to have these two, I guess, sort of gossiping about curly-haired men and talking about, you know, who are they going to fall in love with and who's talking to them when and where and pining after fiancés that aren't present. It gives them a veneer of youth, I guess, or I don't know, of inexperience, perhaps, in the world.
Who's the American, the cowboy? What's his last name?
Morris. Quincy? Yeah, Quincy.
Quincy, yeah. He incessantly, like, in the letters, refers to Lucy as, you know, a child.
Little girl, yeah.
A girl, little girl. Yeah, there we go, little girl. I think you're right with this honing in on this concept of maturity and an age of Mina and Lucy. You know, we read it today as demeaning in a lot it's of creepy. Ways. It's super creepy, and the way that Mina talks about how she wants to be subservient to Jonathan, she's going to learn how to type. She's going to learn how to take shorthand. She's practicing earnestly so that she may be of, like, air quotes, some use to him. There's a lot of that kind of stuff that's playing out. And then we've got Lucy basically playing the field with her bows. And it's funky, man.
It's funky.
But I think within the overall Victorian story that we're telling, or that Stoker is sort of wrapping around here, this issue of, like, domination and subservience and sex and all this kind of stuff, it totally makes sense. And I don't want to get this, like, too sexy too quick. We'll get to it. But the way that this plays out is, it's icky by modern standards. But to me, it's still very accessible. Like, you don't read this and just automatically get turned off. It just seems very hokey once you switch over to the Mina and the Lucy stories. What do you guys think about that?
I buy that. I also, and maybe this is maybe too modern of an interpretation, I know that I've read around Dracula. I've never read it directly. But hearing people talk about it, it trades on people's fears of foreign internationals coming and stealing our women. These two are presented very much as you said it when we were introducing them, these, like, chaste, virginal English women, prim and proper girls, literal girls. And the presentation here is very much of, like, the things that could be conquered if we're not vigilant enough.
Okay.
And don't protect them enough. And particularly Lucy, like, Mina seems not proto-feministic, but is, like, sort of has more agency than Lucy. Lucy has her own kind of agency, but that's quickly lost in the thrall of a vampire. I'm not sure where I'm trying to go with some of that, but it seems like there's a lot at play. Like, it's not just gross. It's gross in a useful way.
Yeah, I think that Stoker was intentional in his depictions of these women.
Yeah,
he was playing to type, but I don't know if he was playing a little bit too hard. I haven't read too much other Victorian writing and writing of this era, but the overall intention of the narrative seems pretty strong. Like, the way that he's presenting these women seems as an intentional plot device. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just was thinking about how other women thus far have been represented in this story, and they're either vampires, like, that are man-eaters, literally, or they're superstitious and, you know, see the devil in every corner. And that's the old world, right? Like, things are different there. Yeah,
they represent a freshness for somebody like Dracula in particular. I think that there is something that, like, he's clearly bored with the three hags or whatever he's got at home and is stepping out on them to go find new English girls. Am I wrong? Like,
I think that that movement west and that movement towards, like, the civilized world and culture, I think that is an intentional presentation of things. You've got this old world superstitious horror element that is like going to this new Western world with empowered people just generally, and it's science fictional in a lot of ways, and it's sciencey in a lot of ways, and like Mina is smart, and Mina is a fair and competent character. She's just submissive, and I get what you're getting at with Dracula wanting some like some new blood, some new tale. Like, he's basically he's looking for some more difficult quarry to pursue,
and he still wants to conquer, right? Like, it's not just a land, but it's the land's women. Like, he wants to be master in all things, or at least no one will be his equal. And I think that represents not just men, but women too. Dracula, that is. Like, his view is he's going to conquer it, or at least it's not going to conquer him. We get some other cool insight into relationships here between the three men that are sort of taken with Lucy. And so we've talked about the Texan, Quincy Morris. We've got Arthur Holmwood as well. And then we've got Dr. Seward, who Luke has mentioned.
Yeah.
What do you think of these three dudes in their relationship?
They're sweet, sweet bros, right? Again, not to be too toxic, you know, they know each other from the Broy Boys Club, like sitting around playing games of bridge and drinking snifters of brandy late at night, and they're all lusting for the same Lucy. That's something that comes out. Like, they're kind of talking about, you know, let's get together to fraternalize about her at one point. But they're good. Like, that's the thing, is you get a bit of, like, toxic tradition, but also mixed up with this, like, wholesome presentation of things. Every one of those guys has a cool persona to bring to the table, with Quincy being, of course, like, the classic brash American, Seward being this very intense, very earnest scientist, and, you know, Holmwood being like this strikingly stand up British fellow, right? Like, we get all of these personas. They're all tropes.
They are all tropes. Do you feel like they're bland?
No, I think because they're taken to the extreme, they function the same way that, like, a sword and sorcery trope or a sword and sorcery character works. Like, if you're playing to type and you're writing to formula, if you're going to have an American, you better have a Texan. If you're going to have a scientist, then why the hell don't you make him like Seward, who wants to try to stare down the devil with his intensity and, you know, has like such an earnest demeanor that he's just awkward as all get out. Like, each of these dudes is amped up, and that, I think, works. Does that make sense? Like, because they're played at 11, I think that the archetypes work.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when they're shoved into this three-horse race for the affections of Lucy. Like, to have them compared to one another at their extremes makes them more compelling than they would be individually. If it was just Quincy being a brash Texan, I don't think he would be cool. But setting him next to a man who runs an insane asylum and, like, the coolest, most standest up dude, Arthur, I think makes him a better character in the end. So I didn't find him boring. No, he definitely has a rose between his teeth and is on the lookout for the ladies, though.
But the fact that they get together and that they know one another and that they're collegial with one another, maybe that strains a little bit of credulity, if we want to use that term. But I like the fact that they're like already bros in love, and they're a group.
I think that takes some of the toxicity out of the male relationships here. Like, yeah, they are all competing for the hand of the same woman, but at the end of the day, they are all like Seward and Morris are both super happy for Homewood, right? Like, he's the guy that won, and that, you know, if it's gonna be somebody, it might as well be you, and we're glad that it's you, and we all love her and we love you too. Like, that's how I read that section of the book where they get together for the drink.
I totally agree, man. Like, the way that Lucy is writing to Mina and saying, like, gosh darn it, all these men are just too good for us evil women, you know. All of these guys just got got our best interests at heart, and they're all so good. Like, if they can't marry us, then they at least want to be our friends. That genuine nature, I think, is endearing, probably more especially to us as guys reading the story. But I dig it, and to me, like, they are endearing. It does make it less toxic, the fact that they're able to all rally around Lucy in her vampiric state that's coming in the next discussion. Mm-hmm. And they're all going to save her no matter what those costs may be. That's pretty badass. Like, they're all willing to make that kind of step. I love it. To me, like, these dudes, whenever I was reading this again, I was thinking more contemporarily about, like, what are their names? Like, Jonesy and Riley from Letterkenny. There's these two, like, hockey bros that are just total, like, D-bags. But they both lust after Katie, who's, you know, the sister of the Letterkenny world. And they're both, like, good dudes. By the time you get past that first episode, they're playing to the archetypes that we see here of Quincy and Seward and Homewood. Like, they are playing to that, like, fraternity and love of women. And I think that's a cool archetype that Stoker was tapping into. It's weird to make the comparison to Letterkenny as a 2020, 2021, 2022 kind of thing. But I think it's true. I think that it's the same vibes, the same feels now as you got like 100 years ago.
We get two other characters in this section that are of note. One is a man named Mr. Swales, who has a cool discussion, I think, with Mina about the sea and sort of sailor folklore and burials at sea and you know, this sort of way in which we honor the dead, at least dead sailors. What did you guys make of that part? John, I thought you might dig that.
Where he's talking about how everything in the graveyard is lies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did like it. I like this 100-year-old man sort of talking about how history can easily be rewritten even when it's set in stone, and talking about how we all sort of make up stories to make ourselves feel better or to project a better image to the community around us, which would clearly be important in this like tiny seaside town where you kind of need to control how your community sees you and your family name. So it was very interesting. And I want to know, I feel like this guy's got to be like Chekhov's gun. Like, there's got to be more to what he's saying later down the line. And I kind of want to see how it plays out. I can't tell. I'm reading your face to see if I'm way off base. But it just seemed like it was this important, weird soliloquy that he had with Mina.
What do you think, Luke? Does Swales' diatribe about being skeptical about things that you see written on the stones of dead men factor in any way?
I mean, I think it's a lot of flavor, and I think it's a lot of cool exposition. Yeah, yeah, I love it. I mean, having that character juxtaposed with, you know, with the woman is a cool thing that Stoker's doing.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say he's kind of the transition into the Demeter, and he's saying, you know, people just die at sea, and you gotta look for the truth, and look, there's a ghost ship out there, and who knows what's happened, and I bet we'll see it in the news. And he seems like he is the flip side version of the people that greeted Harker in Transylvania and were super superstitious and warning him of devils everywhere, whereas he's saying, you know, this is anything like this is foolish. It's fool talk.
Oh, that's cool. I hadn't thought about it like that, but that makes a lot of sense.
He's pointing out, like, what's the idea? It's Chekhov's gun, Occam's razor, like, you know, slice through to find the most logical explanation. And that's probably what happened. And you can imagine vampire attack at sea isn't the most parsimonious explanation for what happened to the Demeter, yet that is exactly what happened. I don't know. I just thought Mr. Swales was cool. And he's not a character that I ever really noticed before on previous read-throughs of this. The other is Renfield. The other character we got to talk about is Renfield. We don't get a lot of Renfield here, but we get a really cool little introduction to Renfield in the last waning bits of Chapter 5, where Dr. Seward is depressed after his rejection by Lucy, and he goes to work.
So I think that Renfield is cool as a character, but I think that the way that he's initially presented and juxtaposed, like, Seward is using him almost as a case. I mean, he is a case study. He's talking about this patient, but the fact that we've got, like, Renfield presented one way and Seward talking about, like, ultimately notes and lines and counting on the chalkboard when it all comes down to it, what's it all going to mean, some level of accounting. The way that Stoker is able to, like, philosophically and poetically wrap up his presentation of this monster of Renfield with, like, Seward's mindset, I think is really beautiful. This has been something that's always stuck with me. Again, Seward is, like, talking into the phonogram. It's a record recording ever since I first read this. I always have this memory of, you know, or visualization of this being something that's a spoken word, crackly gramophone recording. And it just seems all the more poetic that we get this story of this what's the term that's used for him? He basically wants to eat
zoophagus.
Life.
Yeah.
He's a zoophagus, you know, insane patient. It's very compelling.
He's upcycling life force, right? Flies into spiders, yeah. Spiders into birds into cats.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a plan.
What's he gonna do after that? Maybe. Yeah, he is a proto Lecter. Like, he's a proto Hannibal Lecter. Like, Renfield is the contemporary mad homicidal character. Like, he is Hannibal Lecter, but in such a clever and clean cut presentation, he's great. And there's no sex in this guy, which is a cool component. like this is a sex free presentation of things.
Go, John.
Oh, I was just going to say, I had heard about Renfield recently because Universal is going to make a movie called Renfield. I don't know if either of you have seen this. Nicolas Cage is going to be Dracula, and Nicholas Holt is going to be Renfield. And I guess the movie is focused on the Renfield character. It's directed by Chris McKay, who did the Lego Batman movie. So I don't know if it's getting played straight or not. But it popped into my head as I was reading this, and I was like, oh, Renfield's really creepy. I wonder what that means for this movie. Are they going to make it weird like this, or are they going to try and make it funny since Nicolas Cage is involved?
Yeah, I don't know. I hadn't heard of that. I'm going to have to look it up. The interesting thing about Renfield is how different he's depicted in different screen versions of the story. In the 30s version of Dracula, Renfield is the main character, and we don't have Harker. Harker's character is replaced by Renfield completely, wholesale. And in the Coppola version, Renfield is a solicitor just like Harker, and going to Transylvania made him mad, made him go crazy. And here we don't really get any sort of background on Renfield. He just kind of is. And I think that's interesting to me, the notion that he just is kind of on this spectrum of having, you know, this worrying personality disorder. And it's pretty clear that he is somehow connecting to Dracula, maybe through that, or Dracula rather is connecting to him. But there's no other, you know, history between those two characters in the text.
Yeah, he's more like the sensitive poet or artist in a Call of Cthulhu story, mm-hmm. the way that he's like feeling the approach of this magnetic attractive force, this evil force, this thing that's coming around, like the stars are aligning and I feel it coming. He's responding to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think those are all of the major characters. We've got a really cool rundown of what happens on the Demeter, which I kind of described as a vampire attack at sea. John, what'd you think of the Demeter attack?
The whole Demeter setup is creepy, right? Like this weird storm rolling in, a ghost ship, Mary Celeste-looking thing kind of hovering out on the horizon. Everybody can see its sails, but doesn't fully understand what's gone on. And then it comes in and they find this man lashed to the wheel with a rosary in his hand. And then you get his log series, which is another, what's the word we've been using? Epistolary.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really neat way of sort of showing us and telling us about what happened on the boat, and letting us have that backstory. So finding out that Dracula hires this whole crew, gets near to the coast of England and starts picking them off one by one and eating them and throwing them off the boat, is pretty metal, I will say. And rolls in a superstorm on top of it is weird and fascinating. A bold choice, probably for 1897, I would imagine.
Yeah, he knows how to make an entrance.
That is true.
Any thoughts about the Demeter, Luke?
I think it's spooky as hell. I love it. I love the idea of just being lashed rawhide to the mast or to the wheel. It's all like, it's so crazy how much is wrapped up within Dracula that is not within the movies and not within like pop culture. You know, already with all this stuff we've talked about of eating babies and wolves eating moms and the new technology, old world juxtaposition. Like that's something that might get hinted at, but doesn't really carry across whole cloth. Like the idea of the vampire moving across the ocean and like vampire on a ship. That's a very contemporary presentation of that spooky monster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's not something that if you were to talk to people 40 years ago, like outside of having read Dracula, like there's not crazy examples of that. It's great. I love it. All of that is to say the Demeter's awesome, and it's this extra sailory, spooky, like little nested horror story that unspools, yeah, within the larger, it's its own little mini story within the overall like Dracula novel.
Yeah,
that's a good read. Yeah, I like that. The fact that it's a haunted ship story in the middle of a greater vampire tale.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should have led with that instead of beat around the bush. But it's just a cool extra spooky ass element to the story.
I'm a big fan of the fact that we don't get the, like, if this was a movie, there would have been an obligatory, I feel like, Dracula unveiling, like, the mist turns into a bat, or, like, you see his form in the clouds as he arrives in England, and instead, he's a dog that, like, ducks out of the ship before anybody can get there and just infiltrates the island. It's very covert, and I like that a lot. It's very subtle and creates an even spookier scenario when they start to have the funeral later for the lost captain, the only member left of this boat, where a dog senses what's going on, seemingly, and sort of has a prescient attack about what's going to happen next and what's in store for Lucy as Dracula infiltrates the British Isles.
Mm-hmm. And that seems like a good place to leave off with this part of the novel. Do you guys have any further comments or things that we missed that you want to point out before we move, before we bring it to a close tonight and move forward with the next third or so of the book next time?
No, I think we have sucked this dry. we've gotten what we could out of the first third. I will say, I think it's an odd setup to get to where we're at now. Like, the fact that it really does start off very dense with Harker showing off kind of how smart he is. It feels like Stoker is kind of showing off everything he knows about the Carpathian region. And it quickly transitions into this bizarre baby-eating dog man haunted boat adventure. Like, it has a whirlwind to it that you don't expect after you read the first 20 or 30 pages, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I feel like, I don't know. I hope I haven't meandered too much on this recording. I feel like every time I happen to listen to our shows after the fact, I'm like, Jesus, Luke just is rambling around. Like, I don't know. We probably all feel that way about our remarks.
Yeah.
I feel like here I'm talking about this story that I really do love. And I guess the thing that I would say, and maybe you're in the same boat as me, Josh, but I've mowed through this first third of the novel without having really gone deep within the Klinger annotated Dracula margins. And so that's something that between now and the next recording, I'm going to, like, basically speed through the front third of the novel, because I wasn't reading it in the Klinger edition. I'm going to look at all the margins and see what kind of extra information is plugged in there. And between now and the next conversation, I'm going to be a bit more informed to talk about the actual, like, background information that we know about the novel. Because at this point, I've kind of been just talking about my own opinions mm-hmm. and perceptions of things. So, I don't know. Did you get a chance to really dive into your Klinger edition, Josh?
No, and it wasn't for lack of an attempt, but I was able to read the first two chapters worth of annotations. And honestly, there's so much there. It's so rich and so well researched, and there's just a density of material that it's like reading half again as much text, you know. And so in order to be done with the actual Stoker text in time to read or to discuss with you guys tonight, I had to put the annotated version aside and mow through the paperback version that I have. And I guess we should have said that John and I are reading the Signet Classic edition of this book. Our cover has a creepy tree, so we keep referring to it as the creepy tree edition. And then Luke, you've got a cool is it from Walmart circa 1994? Like, it's got a cool drawing of Dracula on the front of it.
Yeah, so I have the Klinger edition from this last year. That was a Christmas present from 2020 from Liz. But my edition of Dracula is from, it is Squeaks for Great Audio. It's an Aerie Books Limited edition, and it came out concurrent with the Francis Ford Coppola movie, because you can tell on the cover it says basis for a major motion picture, as if it's the only only movie to ever be done. And you could buy it 2 for $1 at Walmart. And this thing has been beaten up and carried down the road to hell and back. But this was my original like copy of Dracula when I was in high school.
Nice.
That I got for 50 cents at Walmart in Mena, Arkansas, circa 1995, 1994, whenever that was. And I'm still trying to find a copyright page. I can't. Who knows if this thing even has a copyright page. But that's the info. It's complete and unabridged. That's what the back of it says.
That's good.
So I knew whenever I read all of it that first time around instead of those abridged versions of like Reader's Digest books.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been tricked by that a time or two back in my younger days. Tom Sawyer, I think, is the notable one that I told you guys about. I was duped by Reader's Digest. But anyway, so those are the resources. Those are the resources that we're using for this for our journey through this horror classic. John, so far, last question for you. So far, what's your first impressions of Dr. Acula?
He's playing a long con. I'm intrigued to see where his next move is, and just what it is that he wants to get up to in jolly old England. And I know it involves corrupting the local populace, but it also seems like he's got bigger machinations at play. So I think he's very canny. I do think he has some of the blood and thunder in him, as I said before. And I'm intrigued to see what it takes to take such a creature down. So what comes up to stop him here in the future?
We'll find out. There's another character, a member of our party is missing that we're gonna meet a key member of this party who's gonna go after Dracula next time when we meet again.
Until then, how can the people find us?
You can find us on the web. You can find us on the web at thecromcast.blogspot.com. That's also where you can find the Cromcast Chronicle, Volumes 1 and 2. Volume 2 just came out recently, midwinter of 2021, and it's chock full of fiction and essays and original artwork. You guys don't want to miss it. It's absolutely free, and it's on our blog. So go to thecromcast.blogspot.com. You can also find us on the requisite social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Call us 859-429-CROM or email us. We're thecromcast@gmail.com.
And whenever we come back, things are going to get real. Things are going to come home to our characters, right?
Yeah.
We're going to see things seriously impacting all of the characters. That's what we're going to talk about. If you guys like Dracula, give us a text. Give us an email and let us know what you think, because I think this is a cool story where we could get some listener feedback that we can plug in. So there should be enough lead time. If you get this information, chime in and let us know what you think about the story.
For sure. And we'll see you a little bit further down that spooky road toward Romania.
With a vampire's kiss, I got a vampire's heart. Now I don't roll out of bed till after dark. See my teeth so sharp and my blood so still. You know I could drink the world and never get my fill. And when I come, I will come on like a dream. With the crimson moon shining down upon my devil's ring. You see, it ain't my fault that I am this way. just a crying in my box, for I missed a day. Lord, what I would give for just one drop of red. Now the dew is on the grass and I am late for bed. And when I come, I will come on like a dream, with the crimson moon shining down upon my devil's wing. And when I come, I will come on like a dream, with the crimson moon shining down upon my devil's ring.